Jimmy, Jimmy Crane, Jimmy Crane's a nerd. Jimmy Crane's an improv nerd. Jimmy Crane's a nerd. Oh,
Jimmy. Hey, everybody, this is Jimmy Crane, and you're listening to another episode of Improv Nerd. And this episode is sponsored by the Improv Network, which is a free online resource for improvisers by improvisers. Make a profile for yourself, your troupe, or your theater. List your teaching credentials, find out about upcoming festivals, and more. Our instant submission tool lets you instantly submit to festivals across the globe. So what are you waiting for? Join the Improv Network today and get connected to improvisers from all over the world. Sign up at theimprovnetwork.org. That's theimprovnetwork.org. And don't forget, if you like what we're doing here on Improv Nerd, write us a nice review on iTunes. It would really help with my low self-esteem. All right, everybody, are you ready? We have got another great episode of Improv Nerd for you. Our guest today is Mike Birbiglia. He is the writer, director, and star of his latest independent film, Don't Think Twice. The storyline is very relevant to people that listen to this podcast, and it goes like this. I'm reading it right off the press material because I couldn't do it justice, and here it is. When a member of a popular New York City improv troupe gets a big break, the rest of the group, all best friends, start to realize that not everyone's going to make it after all. We talked to Mike about some of the themes in the film, like jealousy, self-sabotage, and fame, all things that you know I love to talk about, as well as how he first fell in love with improv when he was in college and the importance of creating your own projects. Before we get to this episode with Mike, I just want to say that I'm still a dad. It's my second week, and I got to tell you something. I'm really enjoying it. And I don't want to use the J word, but actually I do feel some joy. And I'm enjoying so much about it. I really love that people bring food over. We've been eating way too much rotisserie chicken because that seems the food that everybody wants to bring over. But I love holding Betsy. I love singing to her. I especially enjoy how beautiful she's become, because when she came out of Lauren, she was like so ugly, and she looked like a little angry old man. She had that angry old man face, and I'm like, oh God, what have we done? I don't want to have an ugly baby. And between then and now, she's like the most beautiful baby, and nobody's baby is as cute as our baby. It's crazy. It's really crazy how that happens, but it is. So enough about me. Here it is. You're going to love this episode. I'm a big fan of Mike. I'm also a huge fan of this movie. And if you're an improviser, you got to check this out. He does a great job in this movie of exploring things like jealousy and self-sabotage and fame and that attitude that we have as improvisers when we're starting out. We're all going to make this together. And friendship as well. So it's a wonderful movie. Don't Think Twice. I highly, highly, highly recommend it. It opens July 22nd. Here it is, the Mike Birbiglia episode. Enjoy.
Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd, oh yeah. Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd.
When was the first time, it might have been a show, might have been a class, where you fell in love with this crazy art form?
It was, I auditioned for my college improv group when I was a freshman, Georgetown. Actually, when I went to school, I remember I wanted to find a sketch comedy group. Like, I wanted to go to Harvard, actually.
To write for the Harvard Lampoon.
Yeah. And I said it in my interview. I said I want to write for the Lampoon. And the woman was a lawyer. I mean, she just had no interest in hearing that. And she goes, is there any other reason you want to go to Harvard? And I said, no. No. And that was, I think, the nails in the coffin. Also my grades and my SATs. But
you must have been a pretty good student getting into Georgetown.
I was a pretty good student. I was, like most nerds who don't have girlfriends or boyfriends in high school, I had time on my hands to study. So I did well in school. And then, yeah, I didn't get into Harvard, and then when I went to Georgetown, I thought, I'm going to start a sketch comedy group. So I want to be a comedy writer, I want to write for Conan, write for SNL, one of these shows. And then Conan was the big one, though, because it was the 90s. It was that kind of golden era of, that show had, like, Brian McCann and like Smigel and like Louis C.K. was writing for them.
And there
the
was there was actually skits in between the guests and stuff.
Yeah,
like that.
Yeah. There was a lot of like absurdity on that show, and I really wanted to write for them. And then I went to Georgetown, and I went to like the arts orientation, and they did a part of it was the improv group did a short improv thing, and I went up to the guy afterwards. It was Chris Fosdick, who lives in Naperville now, grew up in Naperville, lives there now, was there at the screening with us last night, one of my closest friends. And he and I went up to him, I said, I want to have a sketch comedy group. And he goes, well, that won't happen because it takes years to get anything done at the school because it's just an old conservative institution. But we have an improv group that you could audition for, and maybe you could try to, you could write sketches that we could do as interstitials or something like that. So I auditioned, and I'd never done improv before, but I was cast. It was me and Allison Becker, who is a great improviser and actor living in Los Angeles now. We got cast, and then just in the audition alone, I mean, you probably had this one. You did it for the first time where you just go, oh, this is crazy that this could be an art form because it's so fun, right? Like, it's just so liberating.
And here you are, this nerd, right?
Yeah.
And then when you started to do it, what changed for you?
I don't know. You release your inhibitions, I think.
Were you a shy person up until this point?
No. I was like in student government and stuff. Like I was, and whatever. But I did theater. You know, I was in plays. I was in like, I don't know.
Were you a good actor?
I was in Our Town and Love's Labor's Lost in high school.
Were you a good actor?
I'm just thinking back. I went to David Cromer's Our Town in New York, mm-hmm. which came from Chicago.
Yeah, yeah.
And that, when I saw that, I was like so embarrassed that I had done Our Town in high school. Just to see a great production of something that you've done a terrible production of, you just go, oh no, that's what it's supposed to be. So anyway, I'd done acting or whatever. But yeah, there's something about improv where it's just like, oh my God, all bets are off. You can do anything.
So then you move to New York after Georgetown.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And also in Georgetown, you start doing stand-up as well.
Mm-hmm.
How did you decide to move to New York?
I think in retrospect, my sister Gina lived in Chicago for like 10 years. She worked on Oprah and a bunch of other like TV shows in town. And then she moved to New York. And then I lived in her couch. And I think that in retrospect, if she hadn't moved to New York, I'd live on her couch in Chicago.
Wherever her couch was.
Yeah, wherever her couch was is where I needed to live because there was no rent for the couch. And I got obsessed early on with like Sharna and this group called Frank Booth from the 90s at I.O. Came to Georgetown my freshman year and they did a workshop with us. And it imprinted into my brain, you know, the rules of improv and the idea that people who were adults could do this. You know, it was like Liz Allen and Brian Boland.
Brian Boland was on that team.
Yeah.
I think Lily, was Lily on that
yes,
team?
Yes, Lily, Kevin Mulaney, who was there last night, mm-hmm. Was really kind about the movie. Yeah, I was like, oh, adults can do this too. I remember Sharna wrote in my Truth in Comedy book, I look forward to working with you in Chicago. Because I was like, I'm going to come to Chicago.
So when you got to New York, you started to take classes at UCB.
Mm-mm. I never did.
You never
I had taken a ton of workshops and things. I mean, I did improv for 4 years in college. And mm-hmm. I'd been workshops with Ian Roberts and Matt Walsh, Andy Secunda, Amy Poehler. I mean, I'd done like a ton of workshops and things like Kevin Dorff, like tons of workshops and things over the years. And I actually couldn't take classes because I was working on the weekends as a stand-up comedian. And the classes were all on the weekends. So I couldn't get into a program that I could show up for. But Nick Kroll, who was in my group.
In Georgetown.
Yeah. And in New York, Little Man. Our mm-hmm. group in New York was called Little Man. He took classes. And so he went through the program, and then Owen Burke, who's an improviser who
now his comedy runs Comedy or Die.
Right. Funny or Die.
Funny or Die.
Comedy or Die is more of a philosophical idea.
Right, yeah.
Comedy or Die. But he gave us a chance to have a slot for Little Man, have a slot at UCB, and it went well. We drew really well, and I think that they were happy about that. And so we had a show for like 3 or 4 years.
So how did, most improvisers when they get into improv, they pick one or the other. You picked stand-up comedy, and there was a specific reason for that.
Yeah, because it was more like a job.
In terms of?
Like I could make $40 doing it.
Which was a lot of money, right? Yeah, versus like, what you got at improv.
Yeah, like I would, you don't get paid to do improv in most scenarios. I think in some maybe.
Did your parents say something like, well, we don't care if you do this comedy thing, but make sure you get paid? What kind of influence did
they have? It's not just that. It's like my dad was, I always say my dad's a doctor, my mom's a nurse, and those are professions where people help other people and are ashamed of their artistic children. They didn't understand the idea that you could do anything artistic and actually make a living at it. And so the pressure was really on that I had to sort of make a living fast. And like I said, I was making $40-$50 to MC at comedy clubs around the country. So I was driving my mom's station wagon around and booking myself. And then I sort of peeled off the group at Little Man at that point. Like they went their way and I went my way. That was kind of,
And then, in terms of your stand-up, and I got this from your first movie, that it wasn't really until you started to talk about your life that things started to change.
I think that's pretty accurate. I mean, to the extent where I was reminded of it the other day that it wasn't even just talking about my life, because I started to do that sort of in my mid-20s, but like in my 30s, I started to talk about like things that were deeply embarrassing to me, like my sleepwalking. Like I had jumped out a second story window in my sleep, and that's the kind of thing that like you would, if you told people that, they'd think you're crazy. Literally, I mean, like in the movie, I jumped through a second story window on the second floor of a hotel. And I didn't want people to know that, but then I was in Montreal and at the Just for Laughs Festival, and there was a show called Confessing It, where you confess something about yourself. And Doug Stanhope was on it, and Kathleen Madigan. I told my sleepwalking story, I think maybe for the first time. And Doug Stanhope, who's one of my favorite comedians, was just like, do you do that as a stand-up? And I go, I'd like to, I'm trying to, but I don't know if it'll work. And he was like, you got to do that as your stand-up, And that was a little bit, there's a kind of a Marc Maron type moment like that in Sleepwalk With Me, where the guy goes, you should say that on stage, the thing about my girlfriend. And so, and then that was something of a light bulb moment. But it was when I talked about myself that and kind of what I was embarrassed of, what I was ashamed of, was when I arrived there. I mean, which is, of course, reflected in Don't Think Twice, too. It's like, one of the things I'm most embarrassed of is being jealous of other people.
I love that you are honest about this. I love it.
Yeah, and so I think that.
Who are you jealous of? I'm jealous of you. So let's do the change. I'm jealous of you. Who would you then be jealous of?
Oh gosh.
Louis C.K. Is it people's success that you're jealous of? Their opportunities?
I think I'm a little jealous of Louis. I mean, he's got some years on me, so I can catch up maybe I'm lucky. But I mean, he's impressive, certainly. I mean, in this, I don't even know if people register this fully sometimes, how impressive he is, in the sense that not only is he a great stand-up, great filmmaker, TV creator, he's actually changed the entire model of the way we consume comedy specials with a $5 business model. He got rid of Ticketmaster fees on his tour. I mean, he's kind of flipped the game board upside down, which I wish I were brave enough to do. I mean, in some small way, I do it. I make these films on my own outside the system, and I make my specials and my one-person shows outside off the grid. But I'm not jealous. Yeah, I wouldn't say I'm jealous of him, but I would. Yeah, I'm trying to think of anyone I'm deeply jealous of. I feel like it's the thing about jealousy that makes it kind of a useless emotion is that think about the people you're jealous of, and then think, if you were asked, would you trade your life one for one with that person? Would you take that offer? Whenever I ask myself that, I go, no, I wouldn't do that. So you can't just cherry pick what you want from that person's life or career. It's not fair. It doesn't work like that.
So let me ask you this, because jealousy plagues me. When you get jealous, and you admitted you get jealous, do you admit it to other people and then go create something? What do you do with that energy?
Whew. Write in my journal? I don't know. I'm not comfortable. I'm really not comfortable talking about it, which is why I made a movie about it.
Which I think is very interesting because that is...
That's why I made the movie.
That is a
theme. So I wouldn't have to have this conversation.
Right. I'm glad.
The whole movie is an avoidance of this podcast.
Well, but I think you do it so brilliantly in the movie because nobody speaks about it.
Yeah, you're right. I think Chris Gethard made this point on the tour where he goes, who plays Bill in the movie, where he goes, we're all jealous of somebody because we're it's not just people in show business. We're jealous of someone if they have an in-ground pool and we have an above-ground pool. It's like, it's as simple as that. We're all looking at the person next to us going, how did he get that?
Right.
How did she get that? I don't get it.
So let's talk a little about the film.
Yeah.
All right. You said your wife inspired it.
Yeah. My wife is the source of inspiration of many things in my life. And she made this observation one night after one of my shows at UCB where... I think it was A.D. Bryant and Ellie Kemper and handful of other improvisers. And she goes, everyone's so equally talented and funny, but yet this person's a movie star and this person's on SNL and this person lives on an air mattress in Queens. And I just thought, man, that's a movie. Like that idea felt visual to me. Like I saw a big chill style film. Like a big chill style comedy set in the world of an improv theater. And actually, one of the first images I wrote down, because after Sleepwalk With Me, I wanted to write my films in pictures. You know, I wanted to make sure that the visual metaphor preceded the dialogue. And I wrote down this idea of six chairs of an improv group. And then there's five, and then there's four. And then eventually the group is almost dissolved.
There are so many themes in this movie that I want to talk about, but I want to talk about the process of this because,
sure.
In a way, this isn't typically what you do. Your stuff is very, be it your stand-up, your one-man shows. It's pretty much in the first film. It's pretty autobiographical.
Yes.
Now, you've got to. How did you piece all those six characters together?
Well, I made a decision after Sleepwalk With Me where I really wanted to try to make a fictional film because I realized I don't have many more stories like this. I hope to not jump through a window. You know, I hope to not be hit by a drunk driver and made to pay for the drunk driver's car. I can't bank on that, these kinds of incidents to keep occurring. And so,
do you ever think to yourself, like, why does bad, I mean, to get great material, why do bad things have to happen?
Well, yeah. I mean, that's the nature of comedy. Comedy, I mean, it's a trope of comedy, tragedy plus time. And that's why I always, with my improv shows, I came up with that prompt, which is like, has anyone had a bad day? That's what Sam says to the audience in the movie. But that's what I say in my improv shows in New York. Has anybody had a bad day? Because I thought, well, why don't I ask people for the tragedy? And then in real time, we'll try to turn that into comedy. Sometimes it's hard. Sometimes we do those shows in New York and people's issues are so rough that it's for 15 minutes, there's not a lot of laughs.
What have people given you that you're like, oh God?
Well, at the Dale Close Marathon last month, the woman's suggestion was, my dad and I share an iCloud. And I saw on his screen that he was, texting with a prostitute. And I realized that he was cheating on my mom. And I was like, it was really rough of a thing. And she was fresh off of it and it was really raw.
And I can see in your face that like you feel like sad about it.
Yeah, and I always say backstage before the show, I go, guys, the show's about empathy. You know, this show is about we're trying to empathize with the audience member. And you know, Tammy Sager, who plays with us and was playing that night, she's as empathetic as they come, you know. So she was very invested in that woman's story. And you know, for 15 minutes there weren't a lot of laughs. We'd do scenes and we couldn't find fully the humor in it. And then I related something that it made me think of, which was that I was feeling down that week about this police scandal in Oakland. This was before the recent shootings.
Dallas
and everything. But this was the, I don't know if you followed the Oakland stuff, where there was an underage prostitute who had sex with 15 different officers. Oh, it was just like too depressing. You just go, are police officers, I mean, on your most cynical days, you go, are any of them good? I mean, this is, how many shoot people and how many are sleeping with prostitutes? And it was kind of crushing. And I was asking it in a rhetorical sense. I was asking, like, does anyone know? Like, I was asking the back line of improvisers, like, what do you guys think?
Because I'm upset about this.
Yeah, people were volunteering, like, well, I know a cop who blah, blah, blah. I know a cop who blah, blah, blah. And my friend Gary Richardson, who plays one of the improv students in the film. Oh, you know Gary probably. He's a Chicago guy.
Okay, I don't know Gary.
Oh, okay. Yeah. He was at he was from I.O. And yeah. Yeah. Anyway, he's brilliant. He's the African-American improviser and student who says, I just want to be on Weekend Live, you know. How do you do that? So he and I start having a scene where we talk about our personal experiences with police officers. And he's Ferguson. So you basically, like, you know, I remember walking, you know, I was like, well, I first time I met a cop was Officer Babin came into my school and taught us not to use drugs. And he was like, well, I remember when I was 15 walking down the street and a cop just grabbed me by the collar and said, what are you doing here? You know, and you're just, and it was sad and it was tense, but it was, I think, good improv. I think we all came off and were like, that's of now, and so I think there is some catharsis in it.
But I think, but you also do that in your stand-up.
I do.
In terms of, you're not afraid if you're not getting laughs. You have patience with that.
Yeah.
You're happy sometimes if people leave in a little sad, much like the end of your film.
Sure. I like sad, No, I always say, I with movies, I like my dramas to have comedy. I like my comedies to have drama. I don't. When I watch a drama that has no laughter in it, I just go, but what? That's not realistic. I mean, one of my favorite movies is Life is Beautiful because it's the situation where it's the deepest, darkest, saddest situation imaginable. And Benigni is hilarious. And it's for his son. And it's so touching, but it is funny, too.
What I found interesting last night when I was part of the question and answer for the screening,
Thanks for doing that, by the way.
Thank you. It was a blast. I felt shame that we went too long.
I emailed Ira after it.
What'd you say?
I go, you guys got to get you got to get Jimmy Corain to moderate the Q&A.
I would love to do that. Yeah. Did you really?
I did.
Thank you.
I said he's phenomenal.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's hard for me to take in that. Thank you. You said you snuck back in to see the movie, and it made you cry.
Yeah, I get choked up whenever I see it. Yeah.
What is it about that part of the movie that makes you sad? What do you relate to?
Well, for people who haven't seen the movie, it's about a group of best friends in an improv group, and they're struggling to figure out kind of what's next in their life. And
they're in their 30s.
They're in their 30s, and they've been together a long time. And it's in some ways about a group of friends kind of, in some ways, parting from each other, even though they love each other. And so it reminds me of so many things in my life where I left a group of high school friends, I left a group of college friends, or I left my family to go to college, any of those things. I left a group of, you know, a cast of a play or a cast of a movie or whatever it is. There's so many of those in life. I mean, the themes of improv that are mentioned in the movie, you know, it happens, improv happens in a moment and it disappears, you know, all that stuff is applicable to friendship. Friendship never is going to stay the same. I mean, you have spurts of, like, living with a group of people for 5 years. It's not going to last for 30 years, you know. I mean, it could in some kind of an anomalous situation, but it's unlikely, right?
So it's that sense of loss?
Yeah, it's that sense of, like, nothing stays the same, right? It's like, that kills me. Because you start to get used to living a certain way, and you're like, yeah, okay, I can handle this. And then everything changes. You know, you and I both just had children recently. Yes. That's like that.
Yeah.
I mean, my wife and I get emotional thinking about when our 14-month-old daughter is going to go to college. I mean, it's bananas. It's nuts.
The other thing that I actually cried in the movie because there's a character, I'm not giving anything away. The big thing is to get hired.
From Weekend Live,
which, of course, it's like a Saturday Night Live. Yeah, yeah. And you have a great character like a Lorne Michaels, you know, which, you know, I'm sure you'll be like, he's
Timothy.
Yeah, it's just great. And I actually, when I was in my 20s, had gotten an opportunity to audition. I had the ticket in the hand, everything, and that morning I went in to my agent and said, I don't do sketch, which was so stupid. And at the time, my roommate was Dave Koechner, and he had gotten hired that year. So I could relate to this movie so much. Where did you pull that out of the ether? Because that was that was my movie. I mean, in terms of, that was me, that part, that character.
Wow. I think I know so many people, and myself included on certain days, who are self-sabotaging. I think we all do that sometimes, right?
I'm doing it right now.
Like, we all, like, have a part of us that fears getting what we want. I don't know why that is exactly. I think, you know, there's some part of you that fears if you get what you want and then you're still, if there's still a hole, you're still sort of empty, then what?
Well, I think you explore that in the movie as well.
Yeah.
When the one person gets
one
that.
One person gets it, yeah.
They're not.
Yeah, that person's not so happy. Maybe after all, it's hard to say.
Mm-hmm. How do you get over self-sabotage? Because I look at your career, you know, I would be happy with half of your career. You know, I'd be happy with your scraps. You know,
when we were on stage last night, I was handed a letter from one of the Q&A people, and I read it just now, and it's someone being like, "I'm jealous of your life." I mean, it's two pages typed of I'm jealous of your life, which is what the movie's about, which is kind of a mind fuck of sorts. But
how do you get over the self-sabotage? How do you work through it?
Short-term memory loss, you know, like ignoring your failures or learning from your failures and just being like, it wasn't that bad, even if it was really bad.
Well, I think something you brought up last night was this. You had gotten a sitcom about 8 years ago.
Yeah, a sitcom pilot I shot for CBS, and it was me and Bob Odenkirk and Francis Conroy.
And this was your big break.
I thought it was a culmination of all my years of work. I thought, oh, my dreams come true. And then it didn't get picked up.
And how do you deal with that rejection? Because that had to be like a kick in the stomach.
It was very hard because you're... You know, in Hollywood, everything is, in Los Angeles, everything is, how you're treated is based on what you're worth to people right. at any given moment.
Right, if so, you're making money for people, your self-esteem is through the roof.
If you're making money for people, the way people treat you is like you're a prince.
Right.
I mean, literally, it's like you're royalty. And of course, it has nothing to even do with you. Or your relationships with those people. It has to do with what money you're gonna make for those people. But you don't, when you're living it, you don't quite grasp that. You're like, these are my friends. And it's like, they're not really your friends, actually, weirdly. And so, it's like one of those things where you symbolize money for people, and then overnight they say, we're not doing the show. And then you don't symbolize money for those people anymore. And then those people stop taking your calls, or they take 5 days instead of one day to get back your call back, and they're not that excited to talk to you. And, you know, it's like everything falls apart. You just go, oh, well, what is this? What am I doing?
So then you say to yourself, what am I doing? And then you decide, I'm going to go back to New York.
Yeah.
And I'm going to put up a one-person show.
Yeah. I had been incubating a one-person show in my spare time for actually 7 years. And whenever people ask me about one-person shows, I always point out, because I've done three off-Broadway, I always say, the first one took 7 years to develop. I mean, these aren't easy things. As a matter of fact, Brian Stack, who introduced you and I,
yeah,
told me that you have a wonderful one-person show, yes, that I should try to see.
Right. Yeah, years ago.
What's it called?
It was called I'm 27, I Still Live at Home and Sell Office Supplies.
Yes. So Brian Stack told me that that's one of his favorite one-person shows, yeah, of all time.
Well, thank you. So
how long did you work on that for?
Probably
not that long, because you're 27.
No, right. No, probably, well,
since you were seven?
Probably a couple of years. As you know, you keep putting it up and putting it up, and you start to fine tune.
Yeah,
and then I know you go and try stuff up out in clubs and.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, that show. So Sleepwalk With Me, I had been workshopping sort of at off hours at UCB Theater. So I would take like 6 p.m.s and time slots that people didn't really want at the time. And when I came back to New York, I had nothing. Like, what's wild is that when you have a sitcom pilot and it doesn't go, the rest of your schedule is clear for the year. You thought it was going to happen. You planned for the success of it.
Right, and you told me the money's not even that good.
The money's not even good for making a sitcom pilot.
Was it about $40,000 or $50,000?
Yeah, something like that.
Right.
So
after taxes and...
Less after all that.
You're not going to get by on a year on that.
No.
Not in New York.
And so it's like, now what do I do? And then I thought, well, why don't I take all the production values that I learned about in Los Angeles, which is, I think, what Hollywood does best is they put bells and whistles on things. They make things feel exciting. And I thought, okay, well, why don't we hire a Broadway lighting designer and a director and a set designer and advertise this thing, you know, get subway posters and make it feel like something. And then Nathan Lane agreed to present it sort of very...
What does that mean?
Just put his name on it, you know. It's like... if you imagine this poster where it says a new comedy from the director of Sleepwalk With Me, it just said, Nathan Lane presents Mike Birbiglia in Sleepwalk With Me. It was just his seal of approval, which was, he did for no money or agreement or contract or anything. It was just like, yeah, just use my name. Just because I,
how did he that
was a
come
fan,
about?
He was a fan from my albums and stuff. And he came to see, I performed a piece of Sleepwalk With Me Caroline's, and he happened to be in the audience, and he and I went to dinner, and we really hit it off and became friends, and he offered to do that.
Here's the thing I admire about you. You do stuff like this, and you do Sleepwalk With Me, and you create stuff.
Yeah.
And I want to know, when you create stuff, how the perception changes in terms of getting opportunities, in terms of people in the business.
Well, if it's any solace to actors or writers listening to this, I auditioned for hundreds of commercials, TV shows, and movies in my 20s with zero success. I'll leave a long pause there. Zero success. I was never booked in anything to do anything. It doesn't mean I was a bad actor. It means it's hard to just, you know, go out and cattle call, audition for everything. You know, it's hard. It's hard to, you know, there's a lot of people. And then what happened was, is I made Sleepwalk With Me, and then Judd Apatow just asked me to be in Trainwreck, and, you know, they asked me to read for that part in Orange Is the New Black, and, you know, there was just like a lot of, the phone rang a lot after I made something where I cast myself. That's the thing, when you direct your own movie, you can cast yourself, not just in a part, but in the lead part.
So what is the lesson for people who are
listening? I went basically from being cast in nothing to being cast in as the lead because I have that cast in myself.
So what is the lesson for people that are listening to this?
I think there's no, you know, if you're a creator, a writer, a creator, anything like that, there's no more excuses for not creating.
But I didn't get on a Herald team at UCB. I didn't get hired by Second City Main Stage. What do you tell those people?
Is start your own Herald team. Start your own group. I mean, my improv group, Little Man, we cold called a bar in the West Village before we had a slot at UCB called Absolutely Fourth. And we said, hey, do you mind if on an off night, like a Monday, we could just do an improv show here? And we think we can pack the house with our friends. And we started having like an every Monday night show. And I mean, I think that in my career, at least, everything that I've had happen is because I took a chance at creating something where there was nothing before. I mean, what advice I would give is that the creativeness and the inventiveness that you give to the art form of improv also give to the business of improv.
Business of improv, meaning?
Create your own. If no one wants to give you a slot, create a slot.
Okay.
If no one wants to put you in a movie, make a movie. If no one wants to make create a TV show, make a TV show. Make a web series. Make a podcast. You seem to be dabbling in this.
Yeah, yes, it's working. I'm doing okay. I got you as a guest. You know, it took me a couple of years, but
once I heard the McKay episode, I thought, well, I should do it then too.
Tell me something.
By the way, people should know. I should. Why don't I plug your podcast while you're
on? Yes, sure.
I listen to the podcast quite a bit.
I'm honored. And you also said...
I referenced it last night.
Yes, you did. Could you tell people that?
Yeah, so I heard the episode with The Reckoning, which is a great group
improv
that I've seen perform.
Right.
And Mike O'Brien wasn't in the interview, but they referenced that he used to get naked in inopportune moments backstage.
Like if a big casting person came in.
He would just get 100%. Naked and as a bit, and I thought that was so funny. I was like, "Oh, that's a really nice visual for the Bill character, Chris Gethard's character." So I called Mike O'Brien, and I asked him if it was okay, and he said, "I don't own naked." And he was like, "But thanks for calling." He goes, "Usually people take your ideas and they don't ask," but he sort of gave me his blessing, which was nice. But that was from this. That idea was from this show.
I loved another theme in the film. This whole thing about when people get fame.
Yeah.
Where did that come from in your life?
Well, I mean, I'm in show business technically.
Yeah, yes. And right now you're barely in show business because you're doing this podcast.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
you're moving down the ladder.
Where am I? No, I'm in show business. Some people make it, you know, people get big breaks. And I mean, Nick, one of my improv
Nick Kroll
members from college was Nick Kroll.
And how did you deal when he...
He had his own series.
And how did you deal with his success?
Actually, I never had any issue with it. Of all the people I'm jealous of, I'm not jealous of Nick. And I think a lot of that has to do with the amount of time I spent with him over the years was so many hours. And I saw his growth as a person and a performer. And he became such a great performer and such a great person that I never begrudged him any of it. I really thought, like, man, he put in the work and he really deserves this.
Now, there's another theme that comes up in the movie. I really love this movie. Is it showing? Okay.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you.
That it's not always the talented people who get it.
No, I sure. Yeah, that's absolutely true. There's that whole thing of like, you think Eddie Murphy's good. The real Eddie Murphy was, you know, and then they go, this other guy was a drug addict and died. Like, there's always like,
right, it's always tragic.
That's not a great specific. Right, I don't know that's right, whatever right, story, right. But it's like, there's always like the real guy. Right, Mike Myers got SNL, but the real guy.
Right. Or here in Chicago, they'd always say, you know, Michael Jordan was good, but his brother.
Oh, I know. Yeah. Exactly. That's a funny one.
Yeah.
I think that's true to some extent. I think there's luck in all of it. I mean, that I will say to people hearing this who are actors auditioning for things, one thing that's sort of simultaneously discouraging and encouraging is that when you audition for things, it has nothing to do with whether you're good necessarily. Like, everyone's good. Basically, like, good is the price of admission to even get an audition.
If you're being called into audition,
you're being called in, you're good. Qualified to do the job. And from the director side of it, on my side, a majority of the time, it's like, what do you look like in relation to what I pictured and what the person who's playing your wife looks like and the person who's playing your dad or your mom looks, you know, like there's so much with casting. There's so much. If you look at this poster of the movie behind you, everybody looks different from each other, and that's mm-hmm. by design. You know, all of this just to say that I, after becoming a film director, when I audition for things, I think of it like, doesn't matter. You show up, you know, you commit, you know, you listen, you respond, all the stuff you learn in improv, and then you go home, and you don't think about it. If they call you, great. I mean, I know that might sound sort of flip and like I do it, which I don't, but yeah. But that's the goal, at least.
I want to talk about the character you play in the movie, because it's kind of a not something you've done before.
Yeah, no, he's a bit of a scoundrel.
He's a bit of a scoundrel. He's bitter.
He's bitter. He's a womanizer.
He's entitled.
He's entitled.
I could really relate to this character. I just want to let you know.
He's built.
There were so many of these characters that had a part of me into.
Yes.
What was fun about playing that character? Why did you want to play that character?
It was Gillian's favorite character. It was funny because I would, you know, I'd be Miles and then I'd be Mike Birbiglia, the director. And Gillian always thought it was so funny because it was like, she was just like, you're nothing like that person. But when you do it, she just thought it was really funny that he's such an absurd person that, like, he's always thinking about himself. Like, someone says, oh, people were here from Weekend Live. He's like, well, I auditioned in 2003. You know, it's always about him. And it's like, you know, if I were on the show, what I would do. Nobody cares, Miles. Like, it's just, in some ways, it's a great, like, pile-on character. Yeah.
What part of you is in Miles?
I think, you know, on my worst day, I get very jealous of people in different situations, that kind of thing.
Are you bitter?
Right now, I'm not.
Okay.
No.
Are you entitled?
In what way?
In Miles's way. Like, he, you know, he felt, you know, he was owed something.
No, I don't feel like I'm owed anything. I feel aspirational right now about independent projects. I feel aspirational, and maybe when the movie comes out, you know, any day now, it's like my aspirations will be crushed. But I feel aspirational about like independent films are something that we should all support, you know. And I'll say, you know, if you're listening to this, go see Captain Fantastic, go see Tickled, go see Wiener, you know. There's a ton of indie films, Love and Friendship with Stillman's movie. And there's so many indie films that to me are much more interesting than your typical studio film. So I'm not all studio films, I want to be clear. I love the Lego movie. You know, I love, like, the Pixar movies. There's certain films I love, but I get upset when films sort of insult your intelligence. And I feel like there's a lot of that in studios.
The other element that I could relate to, and I have this in spades, is with the Miles character, is the comedy snob.
Yeah, he's a comedy snob, yeah. You know? And maybe I have a little bit of that. But I also, like, enjoy failure. I enjoy people trying.
What is it that you enjoy in the failure?
Well, because it's it's a reflection of myself. It's my own failures. I think that's why the movie's fun in some ways. It's like these characters are floundering around and they're jealous of each other and they're struggling, and it, you know, feels like what our lives are like in some way. I hope.
What did you learn from the last movie that you brought to this movie?
A lot of stuff. I mean, one of the things is just shoot more footage. Roll early, cut late, you know, just like get more to work with for the edit. I had the mind of an editor in this one. And then the other thing is no assholes. No assholes in the cast, no assholes in the crew.
And how do you do that? How do you vet the assholes?
Miguel Arteta gave me this piece of advice. He goes, call at minimum 3 people who've worked with those people, every single person, and ask them what their temperament is like and whether or not, look for the red flags.
How were you as a director with the cast? I would imagine it was different from the first one, the second one. I'm just guessing, maybe I'm putting this on you, more confident.
I think more confident. I think, you know, I would often say things like, you know, in rehearsal, feel free to bring up any idea. I will try anything. I trust you guys. I'll try anything in rehearsal. We have 3 weeks of rehearsal. On the day, we gotta shoot what we're shooting. If that means that your character sits here because there's better light, and you know Chris's character is by the window because the framing is better, that's what it's gonna be. You know, I apologize in advance if that doesn't feel like what your character would do, but we're making a small independent film, and it's hard.
And you did a great thing. You brought in a wonderful teacher, coach,
Liz Allen. Yeah.
Why was that important?
Who co-wrote with you one of my favorite books on improv, Improvising Better.
Thank you.
Which, if you haven't plugged your own book on your own podcast, then allow me.
Thank you. Why was that important? Because you're working with actors. You think, okay, they can figure this out.
Because I play an improv teacher in the film, but I'm not an improv teacher. I've never.
So you did
done
it for
it.
Yourself?
Yeah. I mean, she's so appreciative that I included her, but I always say like, no, it helps me. It's selfish. It's good for the movie.
And how did that help the movie, you think?
Well, Liz ascribes to a type of improv that I really believe in, which is the improv from the heart and from the gut and uninhibited and not super heady, more holistic. And that I needed the cast to have that.
And you said something to me last night that she's the best improv teacher.
Yeah,
and
she's the best improv teacher I've ever had.
And I've been lucky to co-teach with her.
Yeah.
What makes her so great, you think?
I think what makes her so great is that she's inspiring. There's something about, I mean, Gillian in a lot of ways, she's Gillian's only improv teacher ever. Gillian had never done improv.
There was two that didn't. Gillian
and Kate McCucci.
They had never done improv.
Yeah, and you know, in a lot of ways, Gillian's performance, if you know Gillian and you know Liz, Gillian's, when she's teaching in the movie, she's a little bit channeling Liz. I don't know. She says, like, there's bright, sparkly eyes, and it's making me happy, or something like that. It feels like Liz talking. But Liz has an infectiousness to her joy and her love for improv and her belief in it being a real art form. And so the degree that she commits to it is infectious.
And it almost seems like you are reinvigorated with improv, too. You said to me last night, this is the most freeing I've been. That's why you like to continue doing it.
I love doing it. I do improv. You know, I haven't done it because of the movie in the last, 8 months because I've been working on the movie. But at UCB, I had a Wednesday slot for a couple years, 2.5 years. And I love it because I don't think. I get out of my head. So much of my life is just, being neurotic, overthinking things, judging myself, feeling bad. Improv is just you can't, it's what people, it's like when people describe why they skydive or why they, ski. You can't think about anything else when you're doing it because you'll die. Improv, it's the same thing, you'll die on stage.
We gotta wrap this up.
Yeah.
One piece of advice you would give an improviser starting out today?
The woman asked us something akin to it last night. She came from Ottawa and she was starting an improv theater.
Yes.
She said, what advice would you give us? I would just say, as people in any creative pursuit, and I try to do this myself, and sometimes I succeed, sometimes I fail, give yourself to whatever you're doing. Because cleverness is overrated and heart is underrated. And not only is yourself something that you can give to your writing and your work, but it's the only thing you can give.
Mike Birbiglia, thank you so much for being our guest. The movie is Don't Think Twice. Go and see it. Thank you.
And there you have it, another episode of Improv Nerd is in the can. We are just churning them out like butter around here. I want to thank our guest, Mike Birbiglia, and I want you to check out this movie, Don't Think Twice. It opens July 22nd at a theater near you. Also, I would like to thank my producer, Dan Schiffmacher. He's the one who makes me sound so slick and so professional. If it wasn't for Dan, you wouldn't be hearing my voice right now. Also, I'd like to thank Sam Bowers, who directed this episode. And a special thank you to Matthew Preston for providing the lavalier mics for this special episode. As you know, we're taking over social media. We're doing it with Facebook. So go to the Improv Nerd Facebook fan page and like us. Also, follow us on Twitter, which is improv_nerd, and check out our YouTube channel, which is Improv Nerd Podcast, all one word, and see clips from our live show. We're part of a podcast collective called feralaudio.com. People like Chelsea Peretti and Dan Harmon and Duncan Tressel all have podcasts. They're some of the most unique and innovative podcasting out there at feralaudio.com. If you want more information about me, Jimmy Corain, and my award-winning improv classes, workshops, and intensive The Art of Slow Comedy, go to my website, jimmycorain.com. You can also sign up for my Improv Nerd blog. I'd like to thank our sponsor today, the Improv Network. And of course, I'd like to thank you for listening. And until next time, remember, walk. Don't run. He's a nerd. He's a nerd.
Let's say Seinfeld was on an island and he was blowing Boris Karloff. What would that be like?
And it might go something like this. Oh, Mr. Karloff, I loved you in Frankenstein, and I love giving you a blowjob. Why, Mr. Seinfeld, I'd love having you